Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast.
We are one church that meets in various locations across Greater Manchester.
For more information about who we are or where we meet,
please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
So for me, the most disgusting thing brings to mind my first year at university. I was in a flat with some other people. And we did a supermarket trip together, learning the way of doing our shopping. And someone managed to sneak a tin of dog food into somebody else's trolley, a tin maybe a little bit like this one. And the person whose trolley it was didn't notice. So they actually ended up paying for this tin of dog food, which made its way to our flat. And so with no dogs in the flat, but some dog food present, we had to decide what to do. So that evening became Dog Food Challenge. And in Dog Food Challenge, it goes pretty much as you'd expect. So the can was opened. And then it was who's got the guts to taste it? Who's got the guts to have a little eat of the dog food? So we were going around, everyone was dipping their fork in, having a bit. I learned that night that I don't have the best gag reflex. It did not go well at all for me. But we love it, don't we? We love those disgusting moments. We love seeing people put themselves out there. That's why a show like I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here is so popular, because we love these famous figures being put through ordeals, the Bush Tucker challenges, they're eating different things, and just making these grim moments for people. I wonder if for some of us, though, the most disgusting thing that we've done didn't come for the sake of challenge or entertainment, but it came out of love. So some of us who have ever been a carer for someone else will know what it's like. We'll know that to provide care for someone, you often have to do things that are not the most pleasant, that are a bit grim, really, but you're taking care of a person who can't do something for themselves, so you'll do it for them. Those who are parents will know there's loads of mopping up of all sorts of stuff that's just really grim and a bit disgusting that comes with the role. Those of you who have dogs know what it's like to daily follow it around, picking up its poo all the time. You do disgusting things sometimes out of love. Well, in the story we're going to look at today from the Bible, we'll see Jesus doing something pretty grim, pretty disgusting. And it's not for the sake of challenge, and it's not for the sake of entertainment. It's not even because of a dependent who couldn't do it for themselves. But Jesus, in what he does, shows a supreme act of love for his disciples. And in it, he reveals what he's like. He reveals his love for them and also for us. And then he calls us to do the same for one another. So we're going to this morning see the servant-hearted love of Jesus. That's our theme, the servant-hearted love of Jesus. Now, in the Bible, we're going to be in John chapter 13. So those of you who've brought your Bibles with you, please do turn there so you can follow along. If you don't have one with you, I've got verses that will appear on the screen so you can follow that way. And yeah, I'll read the first part of the passage. So this is going from the beginning of the chapter. John 13. Now, before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The devil had already put into the heart of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray him. And during supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, he got up from the table. He took off his outer robe, he tied a towel around himself, and he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was tied around him. We've been over the last few months in John's Gospel. We've been doing the series that we've called A Portrait of Jesus. And the idea has been to look at different things that Jesus said, different things that he did, different encounters that he had with people, and to build up from it a picture of what he's like. We're learning about who this Jesus is who we're following. And in these verses that I've just read, we see something about him that builds into that picture, something that's profound, something that's counterintuitive. We've got a situation. So Jesus and his disciples have come to eat the Passover feast together. Now, this was an annual ritual celebration that you'd do with your friends. But it was also the night before Jesus would die. So this was a very significant, a very profound meal that they were having together. And one of the kind of staple features of Middle Eastern hospitality is that the host would arrange for a servant to wash the feet of all the guests who were present. Or at the very least, they'd provide the water and the oil and the towels so that they could do it for themselves. It was like the cultural equivalent of if someone comes to your house, you take their coat, you offer them a cup of tea, you make them feel at home. This was like that in their world. Only there was a bit more to it. It was more than just ritual for the sake of ritual. It came out of a real need, because in that part of the world and in that part of history, people's feet got in a right state. They were pretty gross, they were pretty grim, they were pretty disgusting. The roads were kind of dusty, dirty roads. They weren't like nice clean tarmac. It was like walking on kind of really messy, dirty places. And people would travel by foot. You wouldn't have cars or buses or vehicles. So people, most of their travel would be on foot on these dusty roads. So the dust would accumulate, the dirt would accumulate and build up on their feet. The footwear people tended to wear were like leather and rope sandals, so their feet were exposed to this environment. And because of the heat and the kind of climate, it was really sweaty as well. So you've got this kind of dirty, sweaty, built-up scud on everyone's feet. It was unsanitary. It wasn't very nice. And then the way they would dine, rather than where we do it, where it's a table, where you can kind of tuck your feet out of view and no one thinks about them, the way they do it is they'd have a central table and people would like recline into it. So their feet were sticking out behind them in public view. So these dirty, disgusting feet were on full view to everyone. So there was a need, really, to get them clean. But the idea of actually doing it, the idea of being the one to cleanse someone's feet, that's gross, isn't it? That's disgusting. That's not something you want to do. I don't know how many of you have had moments like we have as a family where you're on a road trip in the car, you're going somewhere, and then there's a child in the back seat who throws up. And it goes everywhere. It goes all over the child, it goes all over the clothing, all over the car seat, all over the upholstery, all over the floor. And then there's that look that you exchange between you, isn't there? Like, who's going to deal with this then? We're both going to be involved, but who's going to take which job? Which are the worst bits? Who's going to have to dive in? And there's just that like slight moment of hesitation, of nobody quite volunteering to step in. And then that like resign. Yeah, we've got to do this, haven't we? Like cleaning the feet would be something like that. Typically, it would be the job of the servant. Now, partly that was because it was so grim and gross. Partly it was considered shameful as well. Like in that culture, feet were considered to be dirty and rude. So it's not something that someone who saw themselves as respectable would take on. It became like a status marker. So if there was a servant, you give the job to them. If there's not, you look around and you say, right, who is the least honourable? Who's the least senior? Who's the person who this job, who's the lowest member of the group? They'll have to do it for everyone else. Well, at this dinner with Jesus and his disciples, there wasn't a servant present. So you've got to work out who's going to do it. So who could it be? Could it be John? John was the youngest of the disciples, it's believed, so maybe it would fall on him as the least experienced, the least senior member of the group. But it's a bit complicated, because John seems to be in like Jesus's inner group, so maybe not him. Or maybe one of the random ones. You know when you read the list of disciples' names, and you get like all the big hitters, like your Peter and your James and your John, and then you get some names who never seem to come up in any of the stories, like Thaddeus, like someone random like him, maybe he would need to take it on. But none of them do. None of them think, well, yeah, that's my position within the group. There's a longing for status. They all want to be seen as important. They're jostling to be the most significant disciples, the right hand of Jesus, the left hand of Jesus. Who's the assistant Jesus in the kingdom of God? They all want that role. And to take on this job of washing the feet of everyone else, that would be a nail in the coffin of any ambition they've got. That would be like admitting, yeah, you're all ahead of me in the pecking order. I'm the last of this group. So no one's doing it, and it gets awkward. The moment lingers because they're actually already round the table with their dirty feet, their stinky feet, all sticking out, and nobody has jumped in to do it. And this moment persists. And then what happens is Jesus, he stands up from the table, he takes off the outer garment that he's wearing, and he takes a towel. And with this towel, oh, that's going to go. Let's put it there. And he takes a basin of water. And he gets down on his knees by the feet of all these disciples. And he himself washes them. And he himself dries their feet. What a moment. What an unexpected, shocking, profound thing for him to do. What do we see? What do we learn about Jesus? How does this build into our portrait of who he is? We see that he's willing to humble himself. We see that he is willing to occupy that low space, that shameful space, that servant space. We're told in the book of Philippians later on in the Bible that though he was in very nature God, he humbled himself, he became human, he took on the form of a servant and even submitted to death on the cross. That's what he does. He lowers himself, he submits, he takes the humble place. Isn't that such a different concept of power to what so many of us might be used to? Don't we think of power as becoming the top dog in a room, becoming the main person, the key one in an organisation. And then you get everyone to run around after you. You get everyone to do the things you want. And you can see these dynamics play out in families, in workplaces, in churches. But for Jesus, what leadership and power and authority looks like is really different. In Matthew 20, there's a moment where two of them, James and John, have been basically asking for the right and left-hand seats. They've got their mum involved. She's gone and said, can my boys be at your right and left hand? Can they be like your chief lieutenants in the kingdom? Can they be like ranked above all the other disciples? That was the request. And then the others obviously get a bit annoyed because they wanted to think of that first. They want the positions for themselves. But Jesus takes them to task. He says, you know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It will not be so among you. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. Jesus has got a really different idea of what greatness or power looks like. It's not power over to get everyone else to do what you want. It's power under. It's power for. It's using whatever status or position you have in the service of others, for the good of others. Not so you occupy top position, but so you lower yourself and elevate the position of others. Power exists to be given away. Isn't it mind-blowing? Not just that God asks us to serve, but that God serves. Isn't that weird? Like, doesn't that go against the very ideas many people would have of godness, of what it is to be God? That he would serve. Does that come with the job? Back in the 4th century, there were big debates about the nature of God. What is he like? Like, what? They were getting into stuff to do with the Trinity, like Father, Son, and Spirit. But the key question that the debate boiled down to is if you had one word to summarize the most kind of essential thing you can say about God, what would it be? And on one side of the debate, you had people who use this word, unoriginate, which is a complicated word, but basically it means like uncreated. There's no cause. He is the uncaused cause. And that's the most essential thing about him. So they're defining God over and against creation as someone who's set apart from it, someone who's more powerful than it, someone who's above it, someone who is so distinct from creation that he's kind of this being into himself. And you've got people on the other side who said, you know what? It's not that that's false. Like, God is unoriginate. That's not the most essential thing about him. Here's a better word, Father. Or some of them would say, love. And to see God defined, not in terms of over, against, and above creation, but within the very relationships of his being, that he's pouring himself out, that he's giving, that he's preferring the other, that his very nature is the love and the service, not the I'm set apart from. And that was the heart of the debate. You know what? It changes absolutely everything when you get it, when you get that the most essential thing about God isn't that he's over and above, but that he gives of himself in his very nature. It changes why he created. Did he just make a creation so he had something to lord it over? Or did he make a creation, the overflow of the goodness of the relationship, so he could love it? What is it to be a Christian? Is it to be invited to serve this kind of tyrant on a throne? Or is it to be adopted into the family as daughters and sons and brought into the family home of this God who has always, for all eternity, been loving? It changes how we engage with the world around us, doesn't it? Do we as Christians see the dynamic of, well, if God's set apart and in charge, we should be in charge as well. We should tell everyone what to do. We should make all the rules. We should be in those positions of cultural power. Or do we engage the world with a towel and with a bowl and with a soap and we're going to serve, we're going to give of ourselves, we're going to be the people who make this place better? Doesn't it change the nature of church that we're not defining this in terms of hierarchical, top-down, authoritarian, do this, don't do that, but we're a family, we're a community, we serve, we give of ourselves for each other. And sadly, so often we go the other way, don't we, as Christians? We take exactly the same way the world does on this stuff, rather than this incredible new paradigm that Jesus is showing here as he washes the disciples' feet. So we see something of the servant-hearted love of Jesus in the actions that he takes here. I'm going to read the next few verses. So jump into verse 6 with me. So he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" And Jesus answered, "You do not know what I'm doing, but later you'll understand." And Peter said to him, "You will never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "One who has bathed does not need to wash except for the feet, but is entirely clean. And you are clean, though not all of you." For he knew who was to betray him. For this reason, he said, "Not all of you are clean." Here we've got two different objections raised by Simon Peter to the idea of Jesus washing his feet. The first one is like, "Lord, you're going to wash my feet?" He's still operating in the like power status paradigm. So if he thought he was too good to wash the feet of everyone else, then surely Jesus is too good for it. Surely Jesus ranks higher than him. So how could Jesus wash his feet? There's pride, isn't there? There's pride in not being willing to serve other people. There's also a kind of pride in not being willing to let other people serve you. No, you couldn't possibly do that for me. I often feel that pride when someone comes around to my house and then tries to do the washing up. I don't know if any of you get that same antsiness. It's like, no, just sit down. But they want to help. They want to do something kind for me. But something in me is like, no, I can't be served by you. That flips a dynamic here. Peter didn't want to be served by Jesus. But Jesus says, "You don't get it right now. You'll understand this later. You'll understand this later." And what was happening in the moment? In one level, it was a revelation of something about Jesus. So we've been talking about that. It was showing the servant heart and nature of Jesus. But in another sense, what he was doing in this moment, it was also a picture. It pointed to what he had come to do, the big mission that he'd come to the earth to perform. And there are hints of that in the passage. It says right at the start in verse 1, Jesus knew his hour had come. This was the time now for everything to step into gear for his purpose. It talks about how he knew he was going back to God. It makes a reference to the Passover. That was the time that they celebrated how God had saved them, how God had brought people to freedom through the shedding of blood. And all that was fulfilled in Jesus. Jesus came to fulfill everything the Passover pointed to. He came to die on the cross. And this story points to that. If there's something shameful about the washing of feet, that is nothing compared to what would happen over the next 48 hours. Jesus was publicly stripped and paraded before the crowds. He was beaten. Blood was shed. He was flogged with whips. He had to face a barrage of insults and taunts. A crown of thorns was forced onto his head. And then he was nailed to a cross in full public view. And people would come and shout and leer and take entertainment in this brutal death that he was enduring. He died as a spectacle. He went to this shameful, servant, low place in the most ultimate degree. And that's why he came. And because of it, he could say to Peter, and you are clean. You are clean. Through the cross, Jesus can make that pronouncement over you and me. You are clean. Your sin, your stain, every blotch, everything that has tarnished you is made clean through what I've done. In the Old Testament, in Isaiah, it talks about how your sins are like scarlet. It's like every misstep, everything we do wrong, it's like it stains the soul. And that's a problem before God. But because of Jesus on the cross, those scarlet sins can be made like snow. He can provide cleansing. Jesus is saying, Peter, you can't do it yourself. Peter, you can't just make yourself all right. You need me to offer you this cleansing. You need to let me serve you. And the foot washing points to the bigger reality of it. I don't know if you're like me, but so often we can try and fix our own mess, can't we? Have you ever done this? When I was younger, I had a job working as a waiter, and I did like events waitering. And we got this one gig working on a TV show. On this TV show, it was like a celebrity kitchen thing. So different celebrities had to run a kitchen, and they'd have like a few tables that they'd have to cook meals for. And I was one of the waitering staff who would go and take the orders, bring it to the celebrity. They'd make the food. I'd have to take it to the people. And I remember that one time, I basically messed up. And I told someone they could have a meal that there weren't enough ingredients left for. So we were meant to keep track of how many orders there'd been. And I said, oh, my goodness, I've made a huge mess here. And there are TV cameras around. So I don't want that. This is going to be embarrassing. So I said, right, I'm going to fix it. So I very, very quickly went and had the conversation, apologised to the guests, sorted stuff with the head waiter, sorted stuff with the celebrity as well, all before the TV director had figured out that I'd got it wrong. Because it was like, there's a mess here. I just have to clean up my own mess. I have to fix it for myself. And we can do that on the bigger stuff as well. We can think, look, I've gone down wrong paths, I've sinned, I've made it through. I'll just fix myself up and then I'll be all right. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. We can't do it. It's only the blood of Jesus that can actually cleanse the sin that we carry. So we must come to him in faith and receive the grace and forgiveness and cleansing that he offers us. And so then Simon Peter's like, all right, I get it now. Okay, yeah, you've got to wash me. Well, not just my feet then, my hands as well, my head. Give me a bath, Jesus. I mean, it was already an awkward dinner, wasn't it? Like, that would make it even weirder. But it's such a typical Peter thing to say. Yet again, we can be like this. We can do the same. Like those times we're a Christian, we've put our trust in Jesus, we found a salvation in him, a forgiveness in him, and then we stumble, then we mess up, then we do something we shouldn't do, and it's like, oh, yeah, I probably wasn't ever a Christian, right? I need to become a Christian again. I need to respond to an altar call again. I need to be born again and again and again. Often, like, people will say, well, I was baptized. It was a response to Jesus, but then, like, I did some stuff. Can I be baptized again? And it's like we want to go through this process from the start. We can have such a tender conscience that it's like every sin or stumble makes us feel like we're now outside his love, like we're now not in anymore. But you know, the cross is bigger than that. The cross is more powerful than that. The cross covers every sin in the past, the present, and the future. It deals with the stuff you did 10 minutes ago. It deals with the stuff you did a year ago, 10 years ago. And it deals with the stuff that you will do tomorrow and in the future. And of course, we want to come and confess and make stuff right. Of course we do. Of course we want to keep responding to his grace. But we can also rest in what he's done for us, in full assurance of the love and salvation he's given us. Jesus is a servant. He loves like a servant, and he offers us that love. We can respond to it. We can receive it. But he doesn't stop there. Jesus then wants us to take this on and to replicate the servant-hearted love that he's shown. Look with me at verse 12. After he had washed their feet, had put on his robe, and had returned to the table, he said to them, "Do you know what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for that's what I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, so you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have set you an example that you also should do as I've done to you. Very truly, I tell you, servants are not greater than their master, nor are messengers greater than the one who sent them. If you know these things, you're blessed if you do them." One of the questions it's really good to ask when we read a Bible story is, so what? So what? I've read this, but what do I need to do now in light of what I've read? Well, here, Jesus spells it out really clearly. It's like, by the way, this is the lesson you should get from the story. It's a teachable moment, isn't it? And I wonder if he has in mind that moment that they all entered the room, they all sat down, they all had their stinky feet out, and nobody volunteered. I wonder if he's referring back to that. And he said, hey, do you see what happened? Do you see what I did here? I want you to learn a lesson from this. And I want you to do the same for one another. You see, the servant-hearted love of Jesus is it's not only something to receive, but something to replicate, something to live out. I love to think of following Jesus in terms of being an apprentice. I don't know if you've used that language for it before. I have an uncle who works as a tradesman, and at different points in his working career, he's taken on an apprentice. So a young lad who'd come and who'd work with him, who'd help him. But the idea is he'd learn from what my uncle knows. So different jobs would come up, and my uncle would do them, and the apprentice would get to watch and see him at work. And it's like, right, now you try. What you've just seen me do, you do it. You see if you can do the same thing. And then my uncle would guide him, and he'd try again, and he'd learn, and he'd grow into it such that then he'd be a tradesman in his own right, such that then he could take on an apprentice and teach her things too. That's how it works. And Jesus is training his disciples here to follow in his footsteps, to do the same mission. He says, as the Father has sent me, I'm sending you. I'm training you up as my apprentices, ready to carry on what I've been doing. And he's training us as his modern day apprentices in the same way. He says, what I've done is an example for you. So as I wash the feet of this group of disciples, I want you to wash the feet of one another and those around you. And I don't think this is something that we turn into like a purely symbolic thing where the main... I don't think it's mainly something to kind of symbolise and be like, oh yeah, we're so servant-hearted, we'll physically do it. That's not a bad thing. But I think the essence of it is much wider than just washing feet. It's whatever the moment is, whatever the need is, do it. Where there's a space that you enter and the choice before you is, shall I jostle for power and status or shall I humble myself and take a low position? Choose humility. Where there's a need that would serve other people and nobody wants to do it because it's a bit icky or it's a bit shameful or it's looked down upon, do it. Where there's a chance to lay down power and pick up a towel, choose the towel every time. Because that's the way of the kingdom. That's the way of Jesus. That's the portrait that we have formed of him. And that's the way he calls us to walk as well. So what have we seen this morning? We've seen something about the nature of Jesus, that he operates in servant-hearted love. And we've seen how this servant-hearted love is for us and how important it is that we receive it. We can't fix our own mess. We need to receive what he's done for us. And we've also seen that as disciples and followers of Jesus, he calls us to show this same servant-hearted love to one another and to those around us. So what are we going to do with it? I think there are three things we can do with this. I think number one is awe. I think we should be wowed, absolutely wowed by this paradigm-breaking God. This is not how you would expect a God to act. It's mind-blowing. It's category-blowing. This is not what we would expect to see, that a God would serve, We should be absolutely filled with awe and wonder that that is what he's like, and then pour that out to him as we praise him this morning and beyond. Secondly, we need to receive this love. Picture Jesus on his knees holding that towel, holding out his love for you. He wants to serve you. He wants to act for your goodness. He wants to bring this cleansing for your sin. We need to receive it. For some of you, this morning might be the first time you've ever thought about receiving the love of Jesus. It is there for you to accept and to receive. And then thirdly, to replicate it. Whatever circumstances you live out your life in, whatever your workplace or community is, to act in the same way and to show this same love for other people.
Thanks for listening.
To explore this sermon or learn more about our church, please navigate to the links provided in this podcast description.
From there, you can connect with us on social media. And you're welcome to check out the music links featured in this episode from our very own musicians.
You can also discover current events and information about where we meet on Sundays and various groups or community projects that you can join in with.
If you're interested in knowing more about us or wish to join us for one of our meetings, please reach out.
Simply drop us an email at hello@ccm.org.uk.
We look forward to connecting with you.